You're listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 492. So, last week on the show, we were debating about what we do during the pandemic times. Do we chime in every week here and talk about how life sucks and it's horrible for bands and, you know, we can't see music and everything is on fire? Or do we provide a little bit of escapism and talk about not that? And We're going to go the escapism route on tonight's show. So this is not going to be a standard episode of the Punk News Podcast. If you want to complain about that, podcast at punknews.org is how you email us. So in lieu of talking about, canceled festivals and certain deaths.
Yeah, I was going to say, in lieu of just going over list after list after list of the canceled events.
Yeah. So in lieu of dealing with reality, we're going to talk about some records that we like. And we're going to do this in a way that is either going to be lazily clever or a complete
cleverly
flop.
Lazy.
Maybe cleverly lazy. So what we're going to do is each of us. So on this show tonight, you have me. I'm Adam White. I'm recording from my basement here in Niagara Falls, Ontario. You just heard the voice of Mr. Tom Trauma in Somersville, Michigan.
Yes.
Yes.
And upstairs in my pillow fortress of solitude.
You gotta wash those. You can't keep them forever. They're full of mites and stuff.
Well, I used to record in my back room, famously, so you could hear my wife putting away pots and pans and my kids yelling and whatever they were watching on the television. I've since relocated to my bedroom, which, Adam, you're a happily married man. You probably have, like, my bed is covered with all these pillows that are unnecessary. So every, like, evening when I go to bed, I have to throw like six extra pillows on the ground, and then when I make the bed in the morning, I put those six extra pillows back. But they work really well as like a conduit to keeping outside noise out while I record. So I refer to it as my pillow fortress of solitude.
That's
also, you guys must keep it interesting because I'm sort of propped up and I'm drinking pretty quickly. So let's keep it light.
Yeah, you're gonna.
You might hear me snoring.
You're gonna pass right out. No, this has the added benefit of you not being on the leather monster chair that we can sometimes hear.
Yes,
squeaking.
I must admit, I came up. I was still wearing jeans when I came up to my pillow fortress of solitude. And I'm like, nuts to this. So I'm, you know, in my sweaty type pants now. So you'll be glad to know.
Wonderful.
What are you wearing for pants, John?
Yeah, that's John Gigilli in Philadelphia, who is or is not wearing pants. We'll find out right now.
I'm wearing the classic John Gigilli pantalone structure, black jeans.
Oh.
Is the one thing really? I've not understood.
Looking sharp, even when no one can see you. I like that, John.
The whole internet's been like, yay, we're working from home. We don't need to wear pants anymore. Like, I'm wearing pants as much as I wore pants before that, which is all the fucking time. I don't understand how people just, like, not exist with pants. Maybe it's because I'm from a cold climate. It's like you can't just wander around without pants, dude. You need
Canada.
Pants.
You have to wear long underwear for like 9 months a year.
I feel like, I guess, dirty or like late. Like, I feel like grease. If I wear like non-normal pants, I feel like I haven't changed my clothes in like weeks. You know what I mean?
My kids.
I just feel
because,
like people.
Oh no! Sorry. Keep going.
No, I was going to say, people do prioritize comfort too much. Everybody's so worried about being comfortable. Put some damn jeans on if you're going to the store. I mean, let's face it, yoga pants for women and whatever for men, these like pajama pants. It's like, come on, dude.
Yeah, it's, you can picture people from like the 1700s and they would wear like, you know, like these super heavy coats and they wear like frills around their neck and their sleeves. It's like God damn, you wear that every day. And but the crazy thing is, like, people didn't clean their clothes then. So everyone's clothes was like super fancy.
Everyone's
but
stoned,
super filthy
too.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. My wife and I have been watching this period drama set like 250 years ago. And like when they have to get undressed to have sex, it's like such a complicated process. I'm sitting there and I'm literally sitting there watching this show on TV of these people making passionate medieval style love. And I'm like, I have shorts, underwear, t-shirt. Oh, and I'm wearing socks. So I have five total pieces of clothing because I have socks on, you know, and these people are, it's something. I mean, that's how they dress in Canada all year round. Don't they sew you into your underwear, Adam, in like September? And then they'll cut you out in April.
Not to be super topical, but we're wearing Dune style still suits to keep all of our moisture.
I gotta say, unzipping is half the fun. I mean, let's be real, unzipping is half the fun.
All right, so what we are doing on this episode is each of us have
or
picked,
taking your chainmail off.
Yeah, each of us have picked a record that we enjoy, and we are going to play a handful of songs from that record and just sort of give give the story, explain that record to the other folks on the show, maybe as if they were not aware of said record. Are we looking for criticism from the other hosts? I don't know.
Yeah.
Are we looking for
feedback? Criticism feedback? Might be too strong
we,
a word.
Are we looking to introduce this to the public in an academic way? I mean, like, hopefully, but we're not that prepared. We're really just looking to fill time and not talk about impending doom for an hour. So if you will indulge
punk
us.
Punk ain't academic, Adam. Punk is something you feel deep in your bowels.
Deep in your bowels. So
deep in your bowels.
Let's kick this off here. So
we are going
to start with Mr. John Gentile. So John Gentile has picked a record. He will introduce that record. He'll play a song and then he'll come back and he will speak as he does. So John, let's do this.
The album that I'm going to cover this week is War Party by Gwar, which came out in 2004. It's a great album, but you don't have to take my word for it. Here's the title track, War Party. Prisoners masturbating loud and war on fire. You got some choice to make. You're of the empire, you're not to inspire. You're facing a name and a cause that's made insane. Come join the war party. Let's see if something lands. The blood stains the desert sands. I hear your politics burning. A piping and piteous sound. The crowd tears apart your corpse. Louder the dragged through the streets with a chain of bloods on their hung from a bridge on the outskirts of town. They never find your head. Come join the war party. Let's see exotic lands. Bloodstained the desert sands. The blood's running through your hands.
Was clear. You did your job with steel. You raped and you killed. Why so surprised that you finally got billed? You put a gun to your shoulder. You put lead through a brain. You
that was a title track to War Party. John, to contextualize this, how does War Party fall in the Gwar oeuvre, and why do we care?
Arguably, War Party is the most important Gwar album there is, and arguably it's the greatest Gwar album there is, and I think I would agree on both of those counts. As the listeners might know, Gwar formed out of the ashes of Death Piggy, or not even the ashes. Guar shot out from Death Piggy around 1983 or so. And their initial run, which is the first three albums, Hello, Scum Dogs of the Universe, and America Must Be Destroyed, are three classic albums. And Scum Dogs and America Must Be Destroyed are widely considered like the Guar album. Like, if you want to check out Guar, those are the two albums to check out. The problem, and those albums are awesome. They're funny. They're funny, but they're like thrash or thrash-y. They're metal. They are just seminal punk/metal albums. I mean, they're great albums. The problem is, after America Must Be Destroyed, they put out about four albums or five albums that were really kind of mediocre. And the next one was This Toilet Earth, which wasn't a bad album, but it was kind of worse in that it was a boring album. And after that, they put out a couple of goofy albums. They put out Carnival of Chaos. Well, they put out Ragnarok first, which was okay. Then Carnival of Chaos, which was overtly goofy. And then they put out We Kill Everything. And We Kill Everything is often considered to be the worst Guar album. And that's the album that I got into Guar with. And in a way, that's the best thing to do as a fan, because that means every other album you check out by them is going to be even better than the one you already like. We Kill Everything was at the height of Guar's excess. They had the most people in the band. If the listeners don't know, Guar is essentially two units. There's the art unit and the music unit, or the musician unit. And really only one guy really travels back and forth between the two, and that's Dave Brocky, who's Odorous Urungus. He's now deceased. To a lesser extent, Sleazy P. Martini also travels back and forth between the two, but he's more of an art guy. And so during the We Kill Everything period, which is 1999, I believe, Guar had a lot of people on stage in the band. There was Clementra Hyman. To a limited extent, there was Sleazy P. Martini, which is Don Dracula. There was Sexecutioner and some other people. And the art department was huge. And the album came out on Metal Blade, which historically is Guar's record label. And I think it did all right, but it had a lot of just goofy throwaway songs, a lot of novelty songs. And Guar, at that point, was no longer threatening. They were almost a comedy act. The problem being is it's too much. Like, Guar is funny just being Guar. And so when they try to be funny, it's just too much that it just kind of falls flat, you know? And so everyone in the band pretty much considered that album to be a disappointment. Fans at the time sort of liked it. I liked it at the time. I still like some of the tracks, but historically that is seen as Guar's low point. Now, if we were watching a documentary, then the next album out would have been War Party, which was, and then they got back together, they turned everything around. But that's actually not what happened, because between 2004's War Party, was I think it was 2002, was Violence Has Arrived. And Violence Has Arrived on the album is basically the band fired a lot of people in the band. A lot of people changed. They trimmed the band way down, and they also trimmed down the show a fair amount. And the idea behind Violence Has Arrived is there's no big convoluted story. There's no big like plot. It's just Guar, Siege of Warfare, Warhammer, Warhammer, the game Warhammer, heavily influenced by that. That's Guar. And so Violence Has Arrived, actually, I think the guy's name is Zach Blair. The guy from Anti-Flag, is that Zach Blair? No, not Zach Blair, Zach something. What's that?
I don't know. I don't know anybody named Zach from Anti-Flag.
Maybe his name's not Zach. He was also in Hagfish, whatever. I think he's in Anti-Flag. The guy was in Hagfish. And they brought him in, and he sort of rejuvenated the band in that Guar was once again a thrash band. They actually like didn't try to be funny on the album. They were just Guar, and that, of course, is funny in of itself. And not that humor is the most important thing of Guar. But then what happened? So Guar was kind of building up steam again, but they kind of fired that guy or he quit because he was straight edge. Guar definitely is not straight edge, and it wasn't quite working out. So they brought in the guy called Corey Smoot, who you would say he's the guy that re-kickstarted the band, but he already had momentum from Violence had Arrived. That being said, there's actually an album called The Corey Smoot Experience, which is actually the early versions of a lot of the songs on Guar's seminal album, War Party, before they got Guarified and turned into Guar tracks. And so what Corey Smoot did is he brought in a bunch of killer songs, compact too. Guar songs were getting kind of 4, 5, 6 minutes. Corey Smoot songs were 2 minutes, 3 minutes long. So it kind of had that punk edge to it to a degree. And the band was rejuvenated, and they really had steam again. And whereas before, where not, you know, attendance was going down, with the steam of Violence Had Arrived, they were all going back up again. And so when you're gaining momentum again, most bands kind of roll the dice and crap out and put out kind of a crappy album. Guar did something that's almost unheralded. Well, not unheralded, but is very rare in music, and that they put out their best album to date. Not only that, is they kind of reignite a whole new golden age for the band, and they put out about five albums in a row that were just absolutely killer. It's very rare for a band to have a golden age and then come back and have a second golden age like 15 years later. It's almost even better than the original golden age. Like, sometimes bands will come back and be good again. You're like, yeah, they're almost as good as they're good. You know, I mean, even like I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. Like, well, Rancid's a bad example, actually.
Maybe the Descendants.
Yes, the Descendants.
Bad Religion is an example of this. Although I don't know.
They had about four clunkers in a row, but they've been on a really good roll since about 2000 again.
Great example. But would people say those newer ones are better than the original? Maybe some people would. But with Guar, you definitely can make the argument that starting with Fires Has Arrived, but especially War Party, they were making their best stuff again. And because Violence Had Arrived had no real story or anything, I think the band was comfortable doing a concept record again. And that's why I think War Party is probably the most important Guar album there is, because it kind of simplifies but explains Guar's function, in that the idea behind the War Party album is that one of the clever things behind Guar is Guar can function two ways. They can function in that we're aliens, we're from outer space, so we're going to point out all the foibles of humanity because you guys are such a lowly form of life. And because we're aliens, we can point that out and we can see what you can't see because we're objective and you're not. And of course, the other side of Guar is they do drugs, you know, they're addicted to fame and sex or whatever. So they amplify, you know, the peccadilloes of the human condition or the sins of the human condition. So they can either be extremely human or they can be not human at all and point out what the flaws of human beings. And War Party was mostly them being aliens, pointing out the flaws of humanity and ridiculing the human condition, which I think is the core point of Guar, to point out why humans are these ridiculous creatures and you know, make social satire as well and political satire. And that was the point of War Party. The idea behind War Party was that Otis Arungis, the singer, and the rest of the band looked around and saw everything humans do, they're trying to blow them, they're trying to kill themselves. Every decision they make, you know, pollution, wars, convenience, you know, technology, everything is human beings trying to destroy themselves, even if they don't know it, but they never can do it. So the idea behind War Party is Otis Arungis and the band was going to run for election. This was during the Obama and – who did Obama run against the first – McCain? No, that can't be right. I guess it was during the first Obama campaign. The Democratic runoff was Clinton and Obama, and so I guess that's about when War Party really started to take off. So the idea behind War Party was that human beings are trying to destroy themselves, so let's make a political movement where the explicit purpose of the political movement is the destruction of humanity, and humans will vote for that because that's really what they want.
2004 would have been Junior's second run against John Kerry.
Okay, yeah, I guess I'm missing. I remember Hillary Clinton. Maybe they just had Hillary Clinton there to be funny anyways. So the other argument that they were making at the time is with Junior, you know, Junior running again, they're like, we're going back to Reagan politics. And I would love to hear what Dave Brock would have to say about the current political scene. So one of the characters in the album was the Reaganator, which was Ronald Reagan resurrected as a giant mechazoid, which was cool. We'll get into that in a minute. So the idea behind the album is that what humans really want is to destroy themselves. So we're going to form a political party where you vote for us to destroy you. And the way we're going to do that is we're just going to drop nuclear bombs all over the earth and eradicate all humanity because that's what you want. And so that was the idea behind the album. One of the interesting things about the album, in addition to that, let me dive into that for a little bit more, is I think that really, I mean, if you look at, like, you know, I always beat up on Green. If you look at Green Day or even like Bruce Springsteen, I don't know if any of those guys really make that insightful, absurdist commentary, but it's absurdist, but it's kind of true. And to me, it's kind of like the ultimate punk rock statement, in that, like, humans are so self-loathing that they really do want to destroy themselves. So we're going to give it to them. And I think that's an extremely clever commentary. And of course, Guar didn't come up with that idea in of themselves, but they structured it in a really amusing way and clever way. And I think a lot of Guar fans just didn't see that at all. And I interviewed Dave Brocky around that time, and I said, does it bother you that people don't see the art and the social criticism in Guar? And what do you think his response was to me?
He squirted you with fake jism and
big rubber cock. Yes,
no, but actually,
cock slapped you.
About two weeks after that, like Odorous was at Philadelphia show. Odorous was signing autographs, and so I went up to him like, Odorous, I interviewed you like 2 weeks ago, and he goes, "Sure you did, sure you did," which is funny, you know. But anyway, Dave Brocky's answer was, it's not up to me to tell people how to enjoy art. If they want to enjoy just for getting blood squirted on them, that's fine. And that's a valid exploration and identification of that art. If they want to take the social and political commentary from it, well, that's great. I appreciate that. And I'm glad about that. But that's not the only thing to appreciate. So he took a very non-precious view of his art, which to me is honestly kind of the height of artistic excellence. You know, like he realizes that you can bend it however you want. And just because you might not be getting it how he wants, that's the point of art. You can bend it to your own perspective. And that's what makes art interactive.
But that's the best. This is the best kind of art, right? Because like when I used to watch Simpsons with my kids when they were little, they could enjoy it at a certain level and I could enjoy it at a different level, right?
Right. So, and also, I mean, to a degree, that's an economic-based answer. Like if he said, my stupid redneck fans don't get what I'm doing, that's a poor look, you know, but you know.
That would actually be a great answer too.
Well, but as Odorous, that'd be a good answer, not as Dave Brocky, you know. So anyways... The highlight of that tour, my friend Matt and I went down to Washington, D.C. to see this show. And it was maybe the best concert I ever saw, one of the best, is at the height of the show, the Regnator comes out to battle with Odorous Urungus. And the idea is the Regnator wants to stop Odorous from getting elected so he can blow up the world with nuclear missiles, which I think is very funny. One of the things I think people miss about Guar is be like, they just squirt blood all over you. I would argue that A, the music itself is as good, actually better than almost any other heavy. I mean, I would say that Guar is better than Slayer, and I love Slayer, you know. But the music itself is.
Man.
Oh, I would definitely say that. I mean, Scumdogs is better than.
All right, go ahead and say it. I
definitely think that's true. People say, oh, it's all about the visual show. The only reason they're saying that is because the visual show is so incredible. If there was no visual show, I think people would say, oh my God, Guar really is amazing musically, and they are. But on top of that, I think to a degree, Guar isn't quite appreciated enough for the sheer art and sculpting skills in the costumes. Because if you see them up close, it's amazing how much detail and cleverness is actually in. Like if you look at, like, remember, there's that super band Lordi or Slipknot. And I'm not dissing Slipknot necessarily. I don't like Slipknot though. It's just like stupid costumes. But Guar, like, there's little jokes hidden in there. But there's like Slipknot, it's scary clowns. With Guar, there's a reason why these characters are here. It's almost like South Park. Like it's a story, and there's a reason for everything up there. So the Regnator comes out, and he's gigantic. Like it's literally like 14, like 12 feet tall, 10 feet tall. So it is like this massive. The engineering in itself is amazing. It's this massive creature, you know, robot creature with Ronald Reagan at the top driving around. It fights Guar. Guar tears off its arms. They tear off its legs. They tear open the chest, and inside the chest, they pull out Nancy Reagan, who is the real driver of the Regnator, which I think is a hilarious inside joke with regard to the Reagan administration. And I think a lot of people didn't get
that. Term, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then of course they killed Nancy Reagan, but I mean, I just thought that was one of the funniest things and clever things ever. That show was awesome. But
I liked it when they sodomized the Pope with the giant crucifix, but you know, I'm old school.
They've done that a whole bunch of times, you know.
It's classic.
One of the things that I guess maybe I'll kind of wrap this up with is the album is a concept album, not in that it tells a linear story, but it deals with a concept. And at the very end, which is interesting, they kind of wrap up the whole thing. The last two tracks are You Can't Kill Terror, which is Guar kind of criticizing the war on terror and saying no matter how many people you kill, there's always going to be terror because it's something that you can't kill. And the more people you kill, that it grows. Which they're not the first people to make that comment, but it's rare to hear a metal band make that that explicitly, especially at that time period. Now metal's a little bit more political than it was in the early 2000s, but it was rare to hear a metal band be that explicit and to go over so many people's heads. But then I think one of the most interesting things, at the very end, there's a song called A Fistful of Teeth, which in the album, War is successful in nuking and destroying the Earth. And it's just Otis Young is sitting there with a fistful of teeth, which is the only thing left of a human being. And he's lamenting that he's destroyed the entire human race, which kind of twists the whole thing. Is humans want to be destroyed, but does Gwar need the humans? Which I think is an interesting angle. And so I think I think people just think, oh, Gwar just spraying blood on people. But if you really listen to some of their best albums, particularly War Party, you will see that there's a lot of interesting levels in there. But not only that, is whereas somebody like I'm going to beat up on Green Day will be so self-serious. They'll be like, I'm the last of the all mother effers. Like, Gwar's able to make these kind of foundational, moving, insightful points, but they're funny when they do it, which I think it makes that more striking and interesting. And so that's why I just think it's one of their most interesting and greatest albums. And I think it's one of the greatest metal albums and albums of all time, for sure.
A Fistful of Teeth is a cool name for a song. Gwar or otherwise, it is a badass name for a track. John, I struggled with this one. I did, actually. And it's for two reasons that none of them are not, neither of them are necessarily, well, I guess they're Gwar's fault. The one is, at least. I mean, I'm generally ignorant of a lot of metal, and my experience with it, and I think this is probably true of a lot of the non-metal universe, my experience with it comes from like whatever tropes or stereotypes about it that I would have picked up through the media, because it's not something that I listened to natively, as like, it wasn't something I listened to as a kid, right? But Gwar has a part in that, because I remember when I was not even a teenager, when I was like old enough that I could, you know, leave the house and go hang out with, you know, some kid that lives down the street and around the corner that is older than me, old enough to go do that and not be in trouble, not feel like I've been kidnapped or anything like that, but still not old enough to be like a functioning human being with real thoughts and opinions of my own. So this is not a story about how something horrible happened to me in some weird guy's basement. But in a way,
what if Adam went to that and we're like, like out of the blue?
Yeah,
like,
dude. Oh, wow. No, but like, so I remember, like, I went to I went and I was hanging out with this guy that I'm sure when you look back at it, it was pretty sketchy. But to me, he was just like, he was the old kid that lived down the street, like my grandparents' house and his grandparents' house. I think they like shared a backyard or something like that, and his grandparents' house had a pool, so we were always hanging out because he was an opportune friend to have. To have in the summer. But at one point or another, like, we went out to we were hanging out at his place, and we would go listen to music in his basement on, I assume, cassettes or something at the time. And he was he must have been he couldn't have been that old. Like, in my head, he was a teenager, but I don't think he was. I think he was like a preteen at best, given the age that I was. And we would go down and sit in his basement, and he had tapes that had he had Metallica stuff, and he definitely had Gwar stuff, and he had a bunch of other stuff that was that was not metal, but I feel that like fell into the whole stereotype that I was building of this kind of like greasy genre of art that was not for me. Like he had what was that comedy band? Was it like green jelly?
Oh, green jelly. Yeah. Right, right? It was called Green Jello, then it became Green Jelly.
Yeah, and like prank call stuff, and just like so he had like all this stuff where it was just mix of just like of like lowbrowish comedy tapes from the bands that were doing the stuff like that stuff at the time, and then like all this like the smattering of metal, and that was where I first heard like fucking Metallica, let alone let alone Guar. But I first heard Guar in that set, and I'm sure I saw, so I don't know what, like, if he had like a fucking VHS or something, or just magazines or something, but like, I remember encountering Guar then and being totally grossed out by it, right? Just like the concept of it, I'm just like ew, this is like, metal is not a thing that is for me, that I want to be involved in. Like, this is, you know, and I don't think I ever expressed that to him. It was just because, like, I was the younger person, so the power differential was, I was just like, hey, I'm in some cool kid's basement, weird, right? But it was always, to me, just like, I'm like, ugh, like I want to go, like I want to wash the grease off of me, having been down there in this world. And I carry that with me for a long time. So I never listened to metal actively when I was growing up. So I'll listen to something like War Party here, and I have a hard time taking myself out of, holy shit, this is the genre of metal, and putting myself into, okay, what is going on that is interesting in that? So I have that like that problem to get over. Plus, Guar, if you are, I don't know, like, how does one get from like zero to I want to be sprayed with blood by this man in a rubber suit? Like, because that is on its definition like an off-putting thing, I would think. But at a certain
honestly,
point,
Adam, like, it's so, like, I'm still not in, like, it's grimy. Like, it is ultra grimy. Like, it's grimy. You know what I mean? Like,
after about 30, you head to the back, you know?
So I'm listening to
mechanical jizz shooters only go so far.
So all I can picture in my head as I'm sitting down and listening to this the first time through is like mechanical jizz shooters and things like that. And I'm like, I feel that my trepidation about Guar as like a weird cartoon that I don't want to watch is holding me back from being like super into what's going on here musically. So that's what I am fighting with on this. So there were definitely moments where I felt like I was like trying to like slog through certain parts of it, because I'm like, I can't get into this past my stereotype of it. So again, that's not really a record review type comment, but that's definitely a where my brain goes as I'm listening to it kind of comment.
Well, I do think there's some valid commentary in that like, certain genres, there really isn't as much variation between tracks as there are in others. Like if you listen to like Led Zeppelin 4, there's the acoustic track, there's the ballad, there's the super heavy metal-ish type track. But in modern metal, every track is kind of modern metal. So if you're not accustomed to that, then it can all kind of sound the same. I know when I first heard Slayer, I didn't really like it till it clicked in my brain. I would say that War Party is one of the more varied Guar releases and metal releases. But that being said, it is very metal, and there's musically, all the songs are like really awesome, but there's nothing radically new with regard to that. So it's, if you're not familiar with metal, it's a lot of metal to take in all at once, even though it's a compact 37 minutes, which I think was smart of them. And that a lot of metal albums at the time were 50, 60, 70 minutes. 37-minute album, that's the way to do it.
And then, you know, I appreciated that quite a bit, not because I was like, yay, it's over, but more from the standpoint of like I like my stuff to come to be fairly succinct, and it's I've really got to be into a band if I want to sit down and listen to something for an hour, and yeah, that kind of thing works a lot better to me, a lot better for me as a contiguous piece of art to pick up. Now, Tom, you are Guar familiar.
I've seen them at least 15 times live.
Jesus.
And I do not own a single one of their albums. And I don't think that's going to change.
You need to get over your Guar-cism.
Well, Guar, this was a perfectly serviceable speed metal album, and I'm going to use speed metal instead of thrash. Metal. No, I think I would call it more speed metal than thrash.
You think it sounds like Jag Panzer?
It doesn't have the heavy right hand of what I would define as thrash. It's the production's a little too tinny. I don't know. I mean, I know it's a fine line because the two terms used to be used interchangeably, like in the early 80s, but, it's fine. I mean, I'd like Bring Back the Bomb is a classic. They still play that one sometimes. It's fine. I don't dislike it, but I don't think it breaks into my rotation. It's just, I don't know what it is, John. I know you and I disagree on this, and I've probably seen them more times than you have, but I just can't get into it. I cannot get into their studio records. And I did appreciate the fact that it was pretty succinct. And like I said, I didn't hate it. I just didn't, I don't know. It doesn't do much for me. I guess at the end of the day, in a live setting, that sort of vaudeville novelty type of music works. But on my turntable, it's not the same thing.
You think the music's novelty?
Well, the way the vocals are delivered and the lyrics and...
See, to me, the vocals are like is one of the reasons why Gwar rises above so many other metal bands.
But if the reason I never buy comedy albums per se.
It's not a comedy album.
Stop getting all defensive. I'm not attacking you personally.
You're attacking Gwar thereby.
I know you're Gwar spokesman. Meanwhile, we've talked about this stupid record now longer than the runtime of the damn record. Nice job, guys.
Well, I'm glad Tom brought up the vote. I do want to mention the vote. I think Odorous Urungus and is probably the greatest metal vocalist there is. Maybe Halford's better. Maybe Ozzy's better.
Come on now. You've said that this musically is better than Slayer and that Odorous Urungus is one of the great. I mean,
definitely.
I just think you're out of your mind.
Here's the reason why Odorous is one of metal's greatest all time singers for sure. Is if you listen to like Cannibal Corpse or even Anthrax, like the guy sings like every single song is sung with the same cadence, the same level of emotion, the same feeling.
Oh, see, I would disagree and say that that's true about Gwar and not about those other bands.
Oh, I definitely don't think that's true at all. I mean, if you listen to like the genius of Bon Scott and AC/DC and why Bon Scott is probably the best hard rock singer ever is he's got an incredible way to inflect words, you know? And like when he says something when he sings like Dirty D's Done Dirt Cheap or Rock and Roll Damnation, he'll bend the word a little bit. So there's meaning beyond the words themselves, which Odorous does the same kind of thing. Sometimes he barks, sometimes he growls, sometimes he does like this mock, you know, almost like, mock like Bon Jovi ballad voice, which is funny. And so when Odorous is singing, he's letting you know that like, even though I'm saying these words, I don't actually mean the words that I'm saying, or I do mean the words that I'm saying, you know? And I think that's why Odorous is so much more interesting of a singer than pretty much any other metal singer, with the exception of probably Halford or maybe Ozzy. In that, like, there's an incredible depth of emotion in the way he sings the words themselves. And also, I like how you can understand, like all modern metal, it's all growl, demonic vocals. You can't understand, unless you're
just... They try to be too heavy. And the fact of the matter is, the production on this record compared to modern metal feels so thin.
See,
I think the heaviness, you know.
I think most modern metal is overproduced and kind of
dirtied up
too much.
I don't listen to a ton of modern metal, for being honest, other than like my old thrash favorites. I don't know, John. Once again, don't take this personally. It just wasn't. I didn't get into it a ton.
I'm taking it personally.
Well, I just think I agree with a few things you said along the way, such as, you know, because I think of the bands that I think of are very funny. And when they tried to do an album that was funny, it wasn't nearly as good as when they were just being themselves. Like the early Meat Men stuff to me is hilarious. But when later on, when they tried to be more funny, it left me colder, you know? So I totally get what you're saying. It's just not my thing, Jeff. I'll go see them live as long as the Dickies or somebody cool is opening. But it's just not my jams.
Well, we will let the listeners decide.
Well, before you do, I want to get one thing straight, just so no one emails us with this point. Zach Blair, member of Rise Against, member of Only Crime, a member of Hagfish. You said Anti-Flag.
John, I must say, the song I actually really like on this record is the shortest one. It's the bonus plan sung in the fake French accent. I think that's a fun song.
The funny thing is that that's considered the worst track on the album, but I actually like that because it like deviates and keeps the momentum going. It
breaks things up a little bit
right before the last lap, you know.
That's Todd Evans, who was, you know, Beefcake the Mighty for, I don't know, five or six years. We interviewed him on Punk Till I Die. Great, funny, hilarious guy. So you should check that out if you get a chance. He's wild. It was one of the wildest rides we've had, but big dude, fun guy.
All right, so, Jeff, anyway. hit him with another blast of War Party here, and then we'll do the next one.
We're gonna do two more songs, or how many are we gonna do?
Two more songs.
Should we do two
more songs?
Let's do two. Whatever. Do two.
We're gonna do Bring Back the Bomb, which is kind of the pair to the song War Party, which is the opening track, and Guar singing Let's Blow Up the Earth. And then we're gonna play the last track on the album, Fistful of Teeth, which finds Odorous in a melancholy mood now that he has finally achieved his goal, which is very Guar-esque, if you will. So this is Bring Back the Bomb and Fistful of Teeth.
Distributing pain. Don't sky black. buzzards fly, scurrying the dead for fresh meat. All I have to shove from my world is a fistful. A fistful. Cherish the sound of splintered shields and bursting vows as we trample the town. The man I saw you, you had tears in your eyes, and as I knew their family, I felt I should apologize. So we made to the fury, our mutant baby had a one foreign car. And buried, but not without charm. But one day my mood changed, and I melted your brain. A fistful of pain is all that remains. Or at least what I think you're called. Fate's finger gives me the blame. If you saw my tears, I know you'd be appalled. A fistful of chain. As I eat our baby, I'm thinking of you. You're not here to feed me, so I ate our child. I wish we had too. I tried to love you, brought up pain. A fistful of pain is all that remains.
We're back. That was John's pick, Wars War Party, from what was the year again?
2004.
2004. Their ninth record, right? Like, that's pretty. Was it their ninth?
Or around there somewhere.
Around there. Pretty, yeah. pretty deep into a catalog. So, right, I guess, Tom, you want to go? You want me to go? Who wants to go?
I really don't care, Adam. Either way, it's fine with me. I can go if you want. I'm not going to probably take as long as John did.
Do it.
And like I said, I know John's getting a little defensive, but the fact of the matter is I do appreciate some of the fact that that stuff works at two levels. And I think the record I'm going to talk about, it works in that way too. As far as, you know, you can enjoy it at a sort of superficial level and still enjoy it, or you can kind of get more of the jokes and enjoy it at maybe a little deeper level. So, you know, I really didn't know what I was going to play album wise and Adam kind of made the joke. He's just like, you know, do whatever Sloppy Seconds album or whatever you want to play. So I'm like, oh, you know, that's cool, we'll do that. So I actually picked the first Sloppy Seconds album, which is their debut. They are from Indianapolis, in case anybody doesn't know, and their debut album came out in 1989. It was on Toxic Shock originally. It's called Destroyed. So let's play the very first song from that record, which is called I Don't Want to Be a Homosexual. So this is Sloppy Seconds from their 1989 album Destroyed. I Don't Want to Be Homosexual.
I mean any nice queer boy. Do you fool with any of them?
Aunt Hottie, you know I dig women.
Don't tell me that.
Christ, let's not go through this again.
All those beauticians and you don't have any boy dates?
I don't want any boy dates.
Oh, honey, I'd be so happy if you turned Nellie.
No way. I'm straight. I mean, I like a lot of queers, but I don't think they're equipment, you know? I like women.
But you could change. Queers are just better. I'd be so proud if you was a fag and had a nice beautician boyfriend. I'd never have to worry.
There ain't nothing to worry about.
I worry that you work in an office, have children, celebrate wedding anniversaries. The world of heterosexual is a sick and boring life.
Sometimes I think you're fucking crazy. I'm real happy just the way I am.
Been a big fan of this album for years. I think the original reason I might have grabbed it is because Are you guys familiar with the cover? Did you see the cover when you listened to the record?
Yeah.
So it is a parody of, John?
Of Kiss's Destroyer album, of course.
Kiss's Destroyer album. That's
not,
right.
Not only is it a parody, I think it might have just colored right on top of it, which I think is hilarious.
I don't think so.
Oh, no?
No, they had one guy, the guy who did all their original art, is deceased now, but I know, but you know, I think that might've been what drew me to the record originally, being a kid who kind of had grown up listening to Kiss. And I still actually love like the Destroyer Love Gun era of Kiss. So I grabbed this record. I really wasn't familiar with the band, and I've been just a slavish fan. I shouldn't say slavish fan of the band is too strong of a word, but I've been a huge fan of them for many years now. And this is where it all started. And I still think this is their best album. And even though they've done some really great stuff since, I don't think they've ever managed to capture the magic of this one record. It was so great because it wasn't politically correct, but I think they could get away with a lot of it because it wasn't mean-spirited. It's one thing to be politically incorrect. It's another thing to be politically correct and to come off as hateful about the people you're making fun of. And I always think Slobbik was able to kind of walk that fine line as displayed by that first song we played. And the other thing that makes this band great, much like Gwar, it works on two levels. There's always like an overt level of kind of comedy at the beginning and a certain amount of pop catchiness. But as you listen to the songs, you'll hear more and more and pick up little bits of lyric that'll make you laugh that you maybe never noticed before. So even though these songs are 30 years old now, well, not that old, 25, 20, I don't know, quite old now. You can still once in a while will still hear something new and it'll still make you laugh. And it really makes you appreciate how clever the lyrics are piled on top of each other. And I Don't Want to Be Homosexual is one of those songs where you can hear it a lot of times and still pick up on clever little things. If anybody's familiar with the sort of classic Screeching Weasel song, I Want to Be a Homosexual, he actually wrote that as an answer to the Sloppy Seconds song, even though there was never any animosity between the two bands. He just did it to kind of, you know, be Ben Weasel.
Oh, I thought the Sloppy Seconds song was a response to Ben Weasel. I didn't know that.
No, it was the other way around. There was never any animosity. So the record was produced by Paul Mahern, who was, I believe, B.A.'s cousin. Somebody told me B.A., the singer from Sloppy Seconds, cousin. And it was actually, the record was actually made over the course of 18 months, which I don't think it sounds like it. I think it sounds like a record that they kind of went in and knocked it out, but the band didn't have any money. So they were like, basically put it on their credit cards and they would pay as they go to try to get this thing done. And I guess they were writing songs the whole time they were doing it. And, there's a lot of like horror movie nostalgia, like the horror of Party Beach and like some references to old like Americana and horror movies. There's Comeback Tracy, which is a great, great song about Tracy Lords, who started making adult movies when she was like 15. And then they figured out she was underage and took all her movies away. There's Black Roses, which is a great song about Catholic guilt. I'm sure you fellas can relate to that. You, my Paisan pals.
Oh yeah.
It's so funny. There's songs about drinking too much, So Fucked Up, and
Janie's a Nazi.
Classic. Steal Your Beer. The back-to-back songs, Germany and Janie is a Nazi, are such classics. I'm going to run away with Germany. I'm going to run away to Germany, and then Janie is a Nazi. And then I Want Him Dead, which I learned talking to the guys later on. So the bass player and the drummer are actually brothers. And there's a recording, a sample at the beginning of I Want Them Dead. And it's actually their parents yelling at them for having burned up a motor, for having run out of oil. And, of course there's a big spoken piece at the beginning, I Want to Be a Homosexual, which is from,
it's John Waters movie, right?
Yeah. Girl Trouble, right? Or something like that.
No, I think it's a more, BA once did a Q&A session on Facebook and it was some movie that I never heard of, but it is something like a John Waters film or something.
He told me very recently when we interviewed him, but I forgot. Anyway, doesn't matter. But there's also, you know, it's a funny album. It's a riotously funny album. But like all good funny albums, there's that little bit of underlying bitterness, I think, that always makes it better. What else am I going to say about this record? I don't know. It's a great record. You should listen to it. Honestly, the proof is in the pudding.
I realized when I was sitting down to listen to this how much I like BA as a vocalist.
Yeah,
because there is a while you could, from like a really, from like a 5,000 foot view, you could look at it and say like, oh, it's a band playing like Ramonesy punk. There's something about his vocal quality that rings a little British to me, but not from an accent standpoint, but from that like early 70s, just like snark, like that acerbicness that you'd get out of bands like, say, like I don't know, like the Addicts or something, or not the Addicts. Sorry, the who am I thinking of? Not the fucking Addicts. What am I thinking of? Starts with an A. The Advert, or Crossing the Red Sea.
The Adverts, Crossing the Red Sea.
Yeah, the Adverts, right? There's just like there's something that is not
that sort of Johnny Rotten sneering.
Yeah,
sort
like
of
there's
thing.
a sneer to it that he never does, we're gonna keep bagging on Green Day. Like he never does that thing where he like adopts a British inflection or anything like that in what he's singing. But there's that sneer that's there, and that sneer in my head. I mean, like you get it out of like the early Californian hardcore bands and Dead Kennedys and stuff like that. But but that's not what I read here. Like to me, like it reads more like 70s UK stuff, and that's kind of cool. So yeah, I'd heard tons of Sloppy Seconds stuff over the years, but it's been a long time since I sat down and listened to any of it in any big chunk.
And you'll hear other playful 70s things, like stuff like the Dickies were a big influence, and you'll hear little bits of things like Cheap Trick or you know what I mean? It has a sort of rock and rolly playfulness at a lot of points. The guitars are doing other things other than just doing the chugging sort of riffing, you know, a lot of playful leads and things like that.
I love this record. I think this record is, I think Tom took an easy out by picking a record everybody loves, but this is a great,
you know, I think you're right, John. I think everybody loves it, but I think it's sort of not nearly as well known as a lot of them from the same era that it's better than.
Well, oh, you mean like Screeching Weasel and that kind of stuff?
Well, those are the peers, but I think it's as good as any of those other classic records, but it doesn't, for some reason,
like
you know,
what?
They never, I think they're definitely in the same league as, yeah, Screeching Weasels, the Queers, the Parasites.
Better. Way
Forest
better,
Sprinkler,
way better.
Records like that
way
were really
better, way
good
better.
Records. Oh, I don't know about way better, but they would definitely. But they never probably got the recognition of a Screeching Weasel. You know,
it is weird, because honestly, if you ask me, like the song compositions on all Sloppy, like Sloppy Seconds songs, especially on this album, the songs themselves are all really good, and then the lyrics on top of it are funny and poignant. You know what I mean? I do think Sloppy Seconds is a level above all those bands are kind of playing directly to a formula, where Sloppy Seconds is certainly they're influenced by the Ramones and that kind of stuff and the Sex Pistols, but they're their own thing. They're their own amalgamation of like almost 80s, almost trauma culture. And what
yeah,
I like
definitely.
About this,
there is that aspect of it. But you know, the funny thing, John, is I've always found this a strange contrast in the fact that, so let's use the Queers and Screeching Weasel as an example of peers of theirs or any of those bands really. The fact of the matter is the Screeching Weasel put out a shit ton of albums, but they went through lineups like crazy. Same with the Queers. Could not, you know, Joe went through how many lineups over the years?
Did the Queers even have a lineup, or is it just Joe Queer?
It's just
dude?
Joe. I don't know. They're recording a new album, and I'm very curious to hear who's going to be on it, if we're being honest. But that my point being is Sloppy has only had one membership change, at least since they were established, when Danny Roadkill, the original guitar player, left in 93, 94, I don't know, something like that. And Ace has been there ever since. But they've only put out four full-length studio albums, a live album, and a bunch of singles and EPs and stuff.
So,
as opposed to Screeching Weasel, who's put out like 15 albums, but couldn't have a steady lineup. I always thought that was strange. But the fact of the matter is they've always gone for kind of quality over quantity. Everything they put out is worthwhile, you know?
Definitely.
You know, if you talk about the Queers or Screeching Weasel or something like that, you're gonna be like, man, some of the albums are really classic, others are just you know, Sloppy, I think because they've been so selective, never went through that. Even though nothing touches the first album, in my humble opinion.
I have a theory.
Who follows them with Grateful Dead like Devotion.
So I wonder if this has something to do with it. Is that like if you want to say compare them to Weasel in this respect, or even a lot of those peers that you mentioned. So this is a band that of course predated the 95 punk resurgence, just because, you know,
because
89 happened before 95 is the math portion of the show. But the
thank you, my Canadian friend, even though trying to figure out how many American dollars your Canadian dollars are worth, I'm glad you can do that math.
Not too much these days. While they predated that, as did Weasel, I feel that like Sloppy never ended up on a label that I felt like was to the 1995 punker cool. Like they never like what they have like what was the source on Toxic Shock, yeah, they had stuff out on Tang.
Like, well, their biggest commercial moment was actually, remember Dexter from The Offspring had a label called
Nitro Records, right? Which was
Nitro, yeah. So they actually put out one LP and an EP on Nitro. That's the only stuff that hasn't been reissued to date. So I'm hoping that they can figure something out.
And Nitro is definitely a label of the era that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But I don't know if Nitro was ever all that cool, right? Like you look at like Screeching Weasel and they had stuff on Lookout, right? Like there was a lot.
Lookout was there, and then they had their own label and
Asian Man too.
Yeah, like
Screeching Weasel reissued their stuff on Asian Man. They never put out an original album on Asian Man. And Ben Weasel is the only guy I know who can't get along with Mike Park, so that doesn't happen anymore either. And then he reissued him again like a few years later on Recess Records. But I noticed the new record has no physical pressing.
And Fat, excuse me, was on Fat as
two,
well.
Yeah, two albums on Fat about a decade apart.
Yeah, it wasn't like the collection, the Weezology or whatever it was
called. Well, they were on Fat when the punching thing went down.
Mm. Well, Fat
and they were on Fat earlier. They did
Bark Like a Dog and Television City Dreams are two records.
Yeah, and they're quite a few years apart. I don't know how many.
Right, so I guess
those two were 2 years apart.
What I guess I'm getting at there is that
the reissue might have been 2 years apart. The actual release dates weren't 2 years apart.
Bark Like a Dog and Television City Dream, Tom, are 96 and 98.
Okay, then they did one later. I'm thinking it was called First the Manifest.
World Manifesto is 2011. That's all Fat. Go ahead, Tom. Adam.
What I was just saying was that like they never had. I feel like a backing of a cool to the 90s skate punk kid. They didn't have the backing of like a cool label at the right time. And again, Nitro is the closest, but I don't think Nitro gets you there because, well, you could argue that, you know, oh, hey, like AFI was on Nitro and they got huge. And it's like, yeah, they did. But so were, you know, there were tons of fucking Nitro bands that no one cared about at the time.
Vandals.
I think like Dexter really cared about, or, oh God, what was that?
Dexter doesn't own the label anymore. So I know there's some weirdness about bands trying to get their stuff. It's probably owned by like one of these.
So I just wonder if there's just like a wrong place at the wrong time thing with Sloppy Seconds.
I definitely feel that way. And you know, and I knew all these bands, you know, the Weasels and the Seconds, these were all my favorite bands before Green Day hit. So I remember thinking to myself in 1994, 1995, I definitely had this underlying bitterness of these guys aren't nearly as good as the bands I've been listening to for the last 5 years. Why are these guys making it big? But that being said, when Sloppy was playing in Nitro, they were making a living playing. They were touring, and I mean, that's how they made their living at the time, which is more than most bands can do now at all, right?
Well, especially now.
But yeah, it's one of those evergreen records for me. I've probably bought it at least four times. The current press that you can get is on Detour Records, which is pretty cool. So. But yeah,
CD wise, there's a lot of cool versions of that record, and actually, like the bonus tracks are different between like three of the different versions.
The original one that got me into it, John, was the, believe it or not, Metal Blade pressing.
That's the one I got too first for $5,
and it's got that great Alice Cooper cover on it.
Right,
and it's also funny because I saw the Coop a couple years ago, you know, and I was thrilled that he played that song that I wouldn't have known if I wouldn't. Sloppy Seconds
version. And unexpected Alice Cooper cover, and Alice Cooper cover from after his prime. Interesting.
Yeah.
Lee.
All right. Well,
why don't I play a couple more songs? This show, Adam was like, oh, this show, you know, we'll probably knock this sucker out in like 45 minutes. It's going to end up being like an hour and 45 minutes.
That's okay.
But yeah, let's do a couple that I mentioned specifically. Let's do Comeback Tracy. And let's do I Want Him Dead. We'll be right back.
on it, see? That's out of your category. You take care of your records and let somebody know what the fuck they're doing with the car, work on the car. Play with your records.
Play with my records.
Scratching and mixing.
Well, I was trying to tell you, you ain't got a goddamn drop of oil in that goddamn.
Well, he said no, that red light come on down there, and he just kept on driving. Number one, your engine light comes on, you turn the damn car off. It just turned over about 50 million times between the time that red light come on, you got on home.
Start with, I think you made your mistake for not taking it to somebody who got knowledge enough to fix it. You should have went over to Ford's.
Just taking it down here to some goddamn hillbilly that don't even know, never even had enough sense of time that car when he got done with it.
Come Back Tracy and I Want Him Dead by Sloppy Seconds. All right, I'm going to come up the be the caboose on this three car train of randomness here. And I'm going to play for you a strange little bit of history here. This is a band that is considered one of Canada's, and this is super on brand for me, by the way, cuz it's a Canada band. But this is one of Canada's greatest cult rock and roll groups. But it is a band that even people in Canada didn't realize existed for the most part until like a good 30 years after they were around. So the band is called Simply Saucer. They're from the Rust Belt steel producing town of Hamilton, Ontario. So just about, 30-40 minutes south of Toronto, city that's on Lake Ontario there. They have a big bay, and that bay is surrounded by all of these big, mean industrial steel producing places that I'm sure have all been packed up and moved to Mexico at this point. But it's where like DeFasco and all these steel places were. When I was a kid and you drove through Hamilton, you had to plug your nose because it was stinky, because it was just nothing but like blast furnaces and stacks with fire on the top of them. Like Hamilton has become really cool. As everyone got priced out of Toronto these days, Hamilton is jokingly considered like the Brooklyn of Toronto, which everyone in Hamilton hates. But back in the day, Hamilton was like a fucking rough ass town. So Simply Saucer existed in the rough ass Hamilton. They were originally around from about like 1973 until 1979. And the record that we're going to talk about is the only record that they ever had. It's called Cyborgs Revisited. It's material that they recorded in 74 and 75. And this is sci-fi themed protopunk. This is protopunk that was bridging the prog era, bridging the space rock era, and then getting into the early punk era. And I'll kind of talk about how the band how they sit in relation to those kinds of things. So before we do that, this song is called Bulletproof Nothing. It is from Cyborgs Revisited by Simply Saucer. Here we go. Saucer is a band that when I brought them up, actually, that I was going to talk about them on this show, John, of course, is like, I have that on CD. And in a way, of course, John does, because if you look at the influences for this band, it is shit that is right up John's alley, right? This is a band that was influenced by Hawkwind. They were influenced by the Stooges and the Pink Fairies and like the Syd Barrett era of Pink Floyd. And then, of course, the Velvet Underground. Like those were all the mix that was going into what Saucer originally was. So at the point when this band broke up, which had been 1979, they were paired in a lot of people's minds with Teenage Head, who was also playing out of Hamilton. But Teenage Head, if you want to stick yourself sort of back in that era, is the much younger band. They were kind of like the quasi rival with Saucer. But the guys in Saucer are older. They were out there playing stuff before there was a punk, whereas Teenage Head has much more of that direct Ramones influence with what they're doing. So from that standpoint, like, Teenage Head is the more contemporary of the two acts that were there. But they're always considered rivals because they're both the two big Hamilton bands, I guess, at the time, although big is maybe not what I should what I should qualify Saucer with. So, and at the time when Saucer broke up, which would have been 79, they were getting lumped in with sort of the first wave of Canadian punk that was coming out of Toronto. So they were spoken of in sort of the same groupings as like the Viletones and the Diodes and all those bands that have played on like that last Pogo comp and all that stuff. But they really were before that. They predated it. And they were from Hamilton. And it's really important if you're from Hamilton to be a Hamilton band and to not be from Toronto. In the same way that Canadians are really snarky about not being Americans, even though it's sort of the same thing. If you're from Hamilton, you're not from Toronto. Toronto is the enemy for the most part, and you don't like them. So you come from somewhere that's more real, that's more rough and tumble, less full of itself. Like that's the Hamilton standpoint compared to Toronto there. So back in their original run, they only had a single 7-inch that was out as their sort of official release. It was a 7-inch called She's a Dog, which was kind of like a goofy novelty single almost. These songs, the songs that are on Cyborgs Revisited, they were recorded pretty much off the floor as demos. They were put together so that they could shop the band around to labels and to booking agencies and things like that. Interestingly enough, it was actually recorded, I'm pretty sure, in the basement of Daniel Lanois, who... John, are you aware of Mr. Lanois?
I don't think I am, no.
So Daniel Lanois and his brother, whose name is escaping me right now, is he's a pretty hugely famous record producer, most famous for producing the big U2 records. So he was the one that produced like the Joshua Tree and Octoon Baby. But he's worked with Dylan and Neil Young and Peter Gabriel and Willie Nelson and all these giant artists. But he was, you know, he was just a punk era guy that was in Ontario for a long time that was just recording stuff out of his basement in Hamilton with his brother. So Saucer recorded this stuff. They had them to shop around, but it was never put out as a record. And the band never was able to kind of get their shit together during that era to actually put it out. So they didn't. And the band faded away. And in this sort of like pre any kind of competent media era, let alone the internet that is going to calcify and preserve everything, just they were forgotten. Like no one, unless you were from that Hamilton scene and you saw them play and you remember them from show posters and stuff like that, like Saucer was gone. They were off the map. So there was a guy that was a pretty like locally famous rock historian in the Hamilton era named Bruce the Mole Mowat. And he's this guy that like you look him up. His stuff is all over the internet about these early writings that he did about the Ontario music scene. But it's all like, even the websites that have his stuff look like they were built in like 1996. It's really amazing. He was just like one of these people that just like took it upon himself to preserve all of this rock music that was happening for the future. And how the effort of this one guy made it happen. So he was a DJ and a writer and all that stuff in Hamilton. And he got a hold of the Cyborg Revisited tapes and he put them out as an LP in 1989. And it brought the band back to some level of prominence, but only if you were a person that was into that kind of like weird proto-punk stuff in 89, which again was not exactly like burning up the universe there. And it brought them back to a degree, got them into more people's hands, but it still left the band in obscurity. Finally, a label out of Hamilton called Sonic Union put this thing out on CD in 2003. And at that point, the planets aligned and all the right people heard this stuff. And it blew up at that point. And all of a sudden, everyone started coming back and revisiting it and saying like, holy shit, like this stuff is great. This is something we should have been celebrating for the past 30 years. And then all the big names in indie rock and in, in alternative music and stuff like that, started picking up on it and talking about it. And like Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth became like a big fan, and the band all of a sudden was on everyone's tongues and existed. And it's been this sort of strange, like, history rewrote itself thing where you talk to anyone that's in the Canadian punk or garage rock scene these days, and everybody knows Saucer and everybody loves Saucer, and it's a huge deal. But this is only because like someone dug it up, because they, you know, and then someone dug up the one that was dug up, and someone dug up the one that was dug up, and then like finally at one of those points of reissues, like everything clicked and people looked and they said like, holy shit, this exists. So the band got back together eventually in 2006, and they've been, you know, they play stuff locally, but this is a small country as far as the music scene goes, and you can still, you know, you can still go out to a bar. Well, not today because of the end of the world, but in better times, you could go out to a bar in Hamilton on a given night and stand in a room with, you know, 35, 40, 50 people and watch a version of Simply Saucer play right now. And it's, you know, the band, like everyone in the room is probably too young to have been there for any of their original incarnations, but everyone is screaming along with every song. Everyone's singing along with everything. And it's this strange thing where like it took 30 years. Like it took history to kind of come back. Now, what I like about Saucer is that, in particular, the shtick is, I think, from an interesting point of view. So there's this space rockness that's underlying a lot of it, but it's not Hawkwind on the space rock scale. It's not Celestial Journeys that they're going on here. It very much reflects Hamilton and the character of it. Like it's scrappy, it's dirty, it's in some future dystopia, but it's not like cruising through the spaceways. It's like fucking fighting Terminators in the alleys, and that's where this works for me. And so we're gonna play a few more songs in a second, but John, when did you run across this?
I ran across, you mentioned it offhand years ago. And for a hot minute, that CD by Sonic Youth was super expensive. So I watched it for like 2 or 3 years until it became like 10 bucks. And then I snapped it up. And it is a great record. I agree with Adam Stage. To me, it's very much Pink Floyd. If Pink Floyd was early Pink Floyd was a punk band, in that there's a very dark sound to it, the darkness to it. But there's also kind of a fun wildness. And it is very much, you know, fighting Terminator 2 in the alleyways, as opposed to, you know, like Zoller X or something like Clean and Crisp. It's down and dirty and nasty. I wonder, the bulk of the CD is all demos. If you get the Sonic Union one, it actually comes with their 7-inch as well as some other demos. The 7-inch has a much crisper sound. And I wonder, and Adam or Tom, maybe you've got one of the interesting things about this is there is a bunch of chaos and white noise and darkness, and it makes the bounce sound almost like the Spits. You know, the Spits is a lot of noise on the records, so it makes it sound chaotic. Had the record been recorded properly, I wonder if it would have been as Landmark, or if this was just, you know, one of those happy coincidences, much like the early reggae records, you know, the early Black Ark records, where some of the energy and excitement and weirdness just comes from the chance of the technological limitations, which kind of gave it that dangerous sound.
See, I think that's probably got a lot to do with it, and I feel that like admitting that in some way is a sacrilegious thing to say amongst the Canadian music scene. But I was reading a Pitchfork review of this the other day, and it made a point which is entirely true, which is that Edgar Brau, the vocalist for Saucer, like if you were to go stack him up against like the garage rock greats or something like that, there's nothing remarkable at all about his vocals. Like, it's serviceable what he's doing. It fits the.
He's meaner though. He's meaner. I like that he's meaner.
He's totally meaner. And if you just a word of warning to anyone that's following Edgar's current universe. He's one of these old rock and roll guys that has some political opinions these days that are clearly not from the woke era But
oh, God forbid.
Yeah, but
sounds
but,
like my kind of dude, huh?
Yeah. Well, hey. But in any case, the like you look at him from that standpoint, and you're like you know, he does a lot of cool things on here. He sounds cool, but like, you know, there's nothing. Like if you scrub it all up, if you clean it up, if you look at it like super objectively, there's nothing maybe he's doing there that's all that unique or all that different than a lot of the other people. But I think that like you can't divorce the band sort of from the story and from the situation that it came about in. And I'm okay to own that, like to say like, yeah, all right, like you know, were this not some crazy long lost discovered protopunk record? And it was just something that I just like, I don't know, found on YouTube one day. Would I be as interested in it as I am? And like, probably not, but you know what? You can't divorce music from context. So I'm okay with that.
Tom, let me jump in 1 second and then I'll let you go. I agree that 100%, and that almost any band, if you cut out this piece and then cut out that piece, almost any band, you say, oh, see, they're just A, B, C, D, E, and F. You know what I mean? Whereas you have to consider all the factors together. And I think all those factors together.
You have to consider the year it came out. You know, the year it was recorded. This kind of reminds me a little bit of like the Death story, you know, Death from Detroit, those
yes,
two black,
yeah, absolutely.
Black guys. Because it was a similar situation, but they didn't play a ton, like live. But
they have played
this,
live. I know that
they
now.
They have
but
recently, but one of the main guys was dead. I mean, they didn't play a ton. Yeah, maybe they not at all. I don't know. But they recorded these songs. It was like, holy crap! But you got two things going on. A, they're making this incredible music in the mid '70s, and B, they're three black guys. So there's a certain amount of. It's just, it's different, you know. I hate to use the word novelty because that's not exactly right, but there weren't a ton of black folks playing punk rock, you know, so it has a certain, you know, it gives it a certain edge, definitely. And because maybe they had a little different influences, it had a different sound. But anyway, Adam, I got to say, I dig this quite a bit. And if this were like from Detroit or one of those scenes where I'm like obsessive about, I could see this really being something that I really dive into every nook and cranny of. But as it were, I did kind of start to drift off at the end because it does have these long drony kind of passages, and some of the songs get kind of long and unfocused where you sort of if you're doing something else, you'll sort of lose it.
Yeah, right. And it's the kind of thing that it would have been improved by being like having a producer probably there at some point and being
I don't know about that because like John said, the part of the magic is the sort of weird, raw, esoteric, bad production.
So
you know what I mean? If you would have maybe put these guys in a studio with a real producer and said, hey, we need to tighten these songs up, we need to clean up this noise, maybe it would have been just a sucky 70s rock band.
That's entirely a true thing.
I don't know.
If you want but more I, noise and chaos.
I do dig this stuff, and I but yeah, there's a couple songs towards the middle where it's just like, oh boy, I like fell asleep, woke up from my nap, went and had a smoke, grabbed a beer, came back in, and the song is still going. You know, one of those type of situations. But no, I dig this though, and like I said, if it were, I think your geographical closeness to it gives you a little more intimacy with it. And like I said, if that was, you know, if this band was from Kalamazoo or something, like the Spits, I probably would probably have really thrown myself into it a little more, you know. More of a kinship to it, you know.
The flip side of it is entirely true, though. Where if this band was from, I don't know, like Reno, then there was no reason I would have heard it, right?
Yeah.
Let alone latched onto it for any particular reason, like even with the context, right?
So it's a cool record. Don't discount. I mean, this is a banging record. I dig it.
No, it is cool. It is cool. I totally agree. I like it a lot. Like I said, under the right circumstances, I could see myself really going gaga over it. But it's cool though. I dug listening to it. I enjoyed it. You know.
Yeah. So
it's just one of those albums I had a hard time. And granted, I was doing other things. I was at work or whatever. It wasn't like I was sitting there staring at the liner notes or whatever, or staring at the lyrics.
It is a record.
It gets away from you.
Yeah, like I've used it for that. Like it's a record that, well, like since I've been
put it on the back.
Since I've been in this home office kind of thing. So there was a double gatefold LP reissue that In the Red put out a few years ago that has like has the full sort of original on it, and then it has a whole ton of live tracks that were recorded back in June of 1975, right?
And, which are not essential listening, probably.
Which are not, right? Like, they basically, like, side one of the record is sort of like the full studio, the full studio set, and then like sides 2, 3, 4 are all this live stuff, right? Now the live stuff it's interesting in that it's not just the songs from the record live, right? There's other things that's there. There's a Velvets cover that they have on there. Like, there's other songs that only ever existed in that live context that show up there. So it's useful from that purpose, but because it's so scrappy and mean, and in some ways like live proggy band, fucking around on stage, it makes for like a really good loud, you know, I want there to be like a wall of crazy guitar distortion while I'm cleaning the basement kind of record. So
yeah. Yep.
So anywho, let's play a couple more from here. And I am going to, in the interest of making a podcast that is not 17 hours long, I'm going to play two songs that are not the big, long, jammy ones because, y'all got things to do. I mean, you don't really, but you do. So we're going to play a song called Nazi Apocalypse, which very much fits sort of like the mean, scrappy punkness of what Saucer was doing at the time. It is maybe along with Bulletproof Nothing that we played earlier is one of the more kind of like proto-punky songs that's on there. And then we're going to play Here Come the Cyborgs Part 1. So there are two parts on the record called Here Come the Cyborgs. The second one is more of the spaced out jam one. This is the one that is a little bit tighter, but it's definitely a little bit more on the prog end of stuff, and it has all kinds of sci-fi shit in it, which is what you want out of your prog flavored bands. So I'm going to play those two songs, and then we'll come back and wrap it up.
Bye.
We're back. So we've each played and talked about some records. I don't know if it was successful, but it was definitely soaked up an hour of our lives. So that's important.
It was fun. It was far more than an hour for one thing, Adam, but it was fun actually. Maybe when, you know, news gets slow, maybe we'll do it again.
Yeah. Well, hey, news is going to grind to a halt because bands can't do shit anymore.
I know.
We're just going to have
no music.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about everyone's live streams.
Someday our grandchildren will gather around our feet and we'll tell the tales of when we used to gather in the same room to listen to live music. You like my Jimmy Stewart?
So,
Gentile, John will be sitting there with his grandkids around his feet going, I used to get fake jizz shot on me from a giant ejaculator from Otis Arungus.
It was wonderful.
It was. I wore a white t-shirt and stood in the front row so I could mix the blood and the jizz and that green shit.
There was someone on Twitter the other day that was like, when all this is done, I'm going to start crowd surfing and I am 40, but it's just going to happen.
Exactly.
So anyways, right, okay, so podcast at punknews.org if you want to email us and tell us if this was a good idea or not. I enjoyed doing this. Maybe we'll figure out a way to tighten up the format, but I'm curious, listener, if this works. I'd be like, like, irrespective of whether you are a fan of Simply Saucer or Guar or Sloppy Seconds, does this kind of discussion float your boat? That's what we want to know, people. And outside of that, we will see you all in a week.
See you later.